I am so excited that for 2024, Your Brand Amplified is proudly sponsored by one of my favorite platforms, Simplified. This AI-driven platform is a game changer for design and video content. With Simplified, I can effortlessly transform lengthy videos, such as my podcast, into engaging, shareable clips and streamline workflows with an intuitive subtitle generator. For designers out there, you can explore the AI-powered image generator, create compelling presentations, and design eye-catching YouTube thumbnails with ease. Revolutionize your creative process at simplify.com with a free trial. Now let's dive into today's guest.
Welcome to Your Brand Amplified, the podcast where we interview marketers, publicists, and brands to learn their stories, what makes them tick, and tips and tricks that make a difference.
This has been an interview a long time in the waiting and making, and I'm so thrilled to finally have Doug Haworth on the show. And Doug, thank you so much for being on Your Brand Amplified.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Annika. It's really a great show, and I'm really happy to be part of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I know you just released a book, which we'll get into. But before we get into the book, the patent, all of the amazing things you're going to talk to us about, which I know I need to get on the list for the book, because every entrepreneur, anybody in business, should understand these concepts that you have brought forth into the world. Before we get into that, let's jump back to the start. I know when you were a teenager, you became interested in concepts and dynamics and looking at things in a different way. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, when I was a young guy, about 14, I got introduced to, as many of us did, taking math back then, the Cartesian coordinate system, which tells you how to plot points in either a 2D system or in a 3D system. And I got to thinking two or three things. One was, are there only always three dimensions? And then in the Cartesian system, in the two-dimensional system, three of the four sections had negative regions. They entertain negative numbers. And in the 3D system, seven of the eight regions entertain negative numbers. And I said, well, what would happen if, because we're positive people, what would happen if we just had nothing but positive numbers? And so I came up with this concept that kind of flashed to me, where I had a system that had nothing but positive numbers in it. And that ends up being this four-dimensional system that I discovered when I watched my wife buying a washing machine, of all things.
Okay, wow.
Yeah.
You started thinking about this concept when you were very young.
Yes.
Did you tell people about it at the time?
No. It had been kind of percolating in my head because I didn't know how to make sense of it. And what I realized, what it did to finish the washing machine study, so we're out buying a washing machine, the washing machine breaks, we need a new one. So the wife says, she says, you know, the machine we have at home doesn't have a very big drum. I said, I'd like to have more capacity. So I thought capacity versus price, that's a two-dimensional problem. And then she said, you know, we only have one delicate cycle at home. I'd like to have more delicate cycles. I thought delicate cycles versus price versus capacity. She's up to a 3D problem right now. So we liked this one machine that we were looking at. And so we went up the line and we saw the next one in the series there. And it had more of everything, more cycles, more capacity. But the price was higher. And I said, what about this one? She says, it's too expensive. We can't afford it. And I realized that our little purchase was going to push the quantity for this machine one step in the quantity direction. And that was quantity versus price. So she was solving a problem that had capacity, cycles, price, and quantity. She was a part of a four-dimensional system. And so I looked around the store and I realized that everybody in every department was solving these four-dimensional problems in their head. And it turns out that everybody solves these problems in a way in which they self-aggregate their behaviors in a way such that you can describe what they're doing, and then you can find anomalies when people try to violate how people look at that market. And that's what we do, is we look at how the market looks at products and how it values them, and then we work out ways to either put something into a new slot, if you're trying to build a new product, try to find an area where there's no competition, or if you've already got something in the market, we tell you if you're overpriced, in which case we'll tell you what happens if you were to drop the price. If you're underpriced, we tell you what happens if you raise the price. And the same thing works if you're buying. So we use this thing we buy and sell stocks with this.
Oh, wow.
And we've put this model together 49 and a half months ago. And as of last week, it was doing 1.7 times as well as the S&P 500, only using S&P 500 stocks, only going long, no shorts,
oh my gosh.
No leverage. Nothing like that. So we did that basically as a validation of the system, and then it turned out to take on a life of its own. So we think that's pretty cool too. But the reason this works is because people generally see things the same way. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's variations, but collectively, everybody kind of sees things the same way. And because they see things the same way, we can actually describe what they see and then work with that. That's how we do use this.
So when you did this washing machine experiment,
yes,
and figured this out,
yes,
how long did it take until you started using it, coming up with the name, the patent, moving forward? Because you had a different career, right? You were...
Oh, yeah. I was 30-some years at Lockheed, and as I left Lockheed, I discovered this. And it took us 6 years to get a patent. The patent's over my left shoulder over here. And so we had the world's first patent on 4D software. And interestingly, when we took it to the patent office, it was an era in which the patents for software were harder to come by because there had been a challenge in the software arena. So it was really hard to get a patent, A. And then our patent reviewer, who had only passed one patent in the last out of 97 mm-hmm. when we came to him.
Oh, my gosh.
And he said, well, you guys are trying to patent mathematics, and you can't patent mathematics. So he said, no, we're patenting the display of the mathematics. And then we showed him how the displays were, our attorneys did. We showed him how the displays were. And then they bought it. So we got the first patent past this guy out of the, you were the second out of 98 this guy ever passed. So we're wow. pretty excited about that. Then, you know, several papers followed. I've got 13 published papers now, soon to have 14. Several of which over this shoulder have gotten best paper awards. And then we worked out a way to make solid 4D models on a 3D printer. And we can show those to people. You can hold them up with one hand. For those of you that are watching on visual, this is a 4D model. So you can actually hold it in one hand and you can figure out what's going on by the various things that are happening here. And then, of course, the book came out. And so the book came out just a couple months ago. And it's also titled Hypernomics, Using Hidden Dimensions to Solve Unseen Problems. And it turns out there's a lot of unseen problems out there.
Well, just where you started with the yes. fact that you can utilize this technique to figure out price variations, you're solving uh-huh. so many issues that usually you just have to market test. And maybe you have some competitive analysis. To be able to actually see a model of what would happen if we raise the price or lower the price, if we reach this market or that market, that's an entire game changer.
Yeah, what this realizes, Annika, is that the forces of value, basically, as people get more of what they want, they're willing to pay more for it. And so getting back to a washing machine, if the washing machine has more and more capacity, people who can afford it say, well, I'm willing to pay for more capacity. If you had a machine that's simply got 5 cycles, but you really need to have 15 or 20 and you can afford it, you want to have more cycles. So as you want more capacity and more cycles, the value goes up. And what we like to say is the features, so capacity and cycles, features drive value. Value determines price. Price limits quantity sold, and quantity sold is a feature. So as these features drive the value up, people can afford to buy it, but fewer people can buy it. So what happens on the demand side is as you start to raise the price, the quantity sold drops. Mm-hmm. And so this recognizes these forces are in opposition, like a balanced equation in chemistry. And so they're both sides of the same thing. And so these things are connected intrinsically and have been since the beginning of time. Now, interestingly, I know that I can say that now because you live in Southern California here along with me, right? So I live just about 40 or 50 miles north of you mm-hmm. in Santa Clarita. So late last fall, or early last winter, I was out, I did a run and got off the dusty trail and was sitting there bent over looking at a, you know, it's on an asphalt where I parked my car. And I was looking at this, I decided to do something that Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize winning physicist, often would do. Just for giggles, Dr. Feynman used to sit there and look at ants. He used to study ants. So I'd never studied ants at all. So I thought, well, I'm going to devote a couple of minutes of my life to looking at this ant. And so I saw this little reddish-black ant, which I found out later, it's got a Latin name, but it falls into the category that are colloquially known as the rock ants.
Okay.
Not rock and roll ants, ants that hang out by rocks. Rock ants. And so I saw this little rock ant, and I noticed that he started moving counterclockwise in little fits and starts. And he was going counterclockwise, and after about, I don't know, 10, 20 seconds, he actually traced out 360 degrees, but it wasn't quite a circle. He was out a little bit further when he got the 360 degrees than where he started. So he He did it again in fits and starts, and he came around again, and he was out further still. And then I watched him go around, and I noticed that he was stopping on the higher pebbles. You know, he's an ant, so he's down these little pebbles. He's on the higher pebbles. He goes out further still, and I go, when I saw him stand up and he's looking around, I realized that little ant is doing reconnaissance. So I raced home and went into Google. I type in ant reconnaissance into my Google search bar, and sure enough, ants do reconnaissance. And what they do, ants look for, this will sound very familiar for those of you who have ever shot for a house, ants look for, you know, new places to live.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're a rock ant, you want to have a new place that's dry, that's got the right ceiling height, can't be too high because you don't want the air whistling in, can't be too narrow, you got to squeeze through it. It's got to be dry, hygienic, can't have a lot of junk in there, can't have stuff floating in, got to be away from near a water supply, but not below the water, and it's got to be away from other ants. Now, that's exactly how people buy properties. They want to have a lot of space, they want it to be clean, and if you could avoid it, you'd like to not have neighbors, so you'd like to have acreage. So these ants have been on the earth before 140 to 180 million years ago. They've been around. So the ant reconnaissance is part of their gross domestic product.
Mm.
Part of what the ants do when they work, they do recon for the whole colony. And so the next paper I'm putting out actually shows how humans do recon, and recon is part of our economy. And I claim that recon has been around for people as long as there have been people. Therefore, these little four-dimensional problems that we talk about have been around since mankind has been around.
Yeah.
Since we started. So it's pretty interesting. I just saw this and I just went, oh, this is phenomenal. Who knew the ants knew that much? But they do. The ants know that much.
Wow.
Only with your daughter's going into neuroscience, she'd be fascinated. I mean, the neurons in an ant, they've only got, I think, 24 neurons or something like that. So it's not very many. But they have enough to know that what they want to do, what they're looking for in a new place to live.
Yeah.
And then they communicate that back to the rest of the colony. I thought that was fascinating.
It is fascinating. And I actually think she will really enjoy reading your book.
Yeah.
She's not in the marketing sales business, right? She wants to study neuroscience with an emphasis on brain anomalies.
Yeah. Okay.
So she really wants to study the brain itself, not the psychology of people.
Right.
But I think I'm like, this is perfect, because I know when I was telling you, because you graduated from Washington State and we looked at UW this past week, and she brought back a tree. And so she started researching all about these trees and like where we would grow it and what pot do we need to get and where are we going to put it, since we know it's going to grow, you know, 100 feet. But it is really fascinating. And she talks a lot about the correlation between people and animals and insects.
Right.
And everything is so connected.
Yeah.
And you're showing us that we really are connected.
Oh, yeah.
To understand that connectivity, that's always existed. Now you have
always existed.
Now we have a name for it. Now we have a construct, a way to look at it and to use it to make better decisions.
That's exactly what this does. It makes it so that people don't make silly decisions quite as often as they do. So there's been a lot of them that have happened. And this is trying to avoid that for a lot of people. And governments, too. Governments, companies, individual buyers, it works for everything that we've discussed, everything.
You've worked with a lot of major organizations such as NASA, Virgin Galactic, Lockheed Martin, of course.
Right.
But you also have the way that this model can work for households or restaurants or NFL players who are trying to run faster.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting you bring that up. I came across this story about Rocky Blyer. Now, many of your listeners may not know who Rocky Blyer is. He's kind of in my age rather than yours, but Rocky Blyer was a running back for the Notre Dame Fighting Irish back in the late 60s. And he graduated and led him to a national championship. And then he got drafted by the Pittsburgh Steelers and he played for a year or two. And then the Vietnam War came and he got drafted. He volunteered to go to Vietnam and he went to Vietnam and promptly got his part of his foot blown off. Not all of it, but part of it. And so he could still walk and eventually run, but I mean, he didn't have his whole foot. And so Art Rooney, knowing that Rocky was a big part of the team, he wrote him and said, hey, look, Rocky, we need you back on the Steelers. You know, please come back. And so he came back and he was 30 pounds below his playing weight. So he had two or three years where he didn't do very well. And then he finally asked himself, well, what would happen if I just laid everything out on the table? And so he had been a 4.8 40 running back, which in running back parlance is pretty slow. at when he decided to come back full strength, he started lifting weights and he got his weight back up to his playing weight and he took his 40 time from 4.8 to 4.6. And he went on to rush for 1,000 yards for the Steelers and he won some Super Bowl ranks. So what I decided to do is I looked at NFL receivers who'd been in the league a few years and got past the rookie contracts. And I looked at what happens if you take your speed from, say, 4.4, or if you go from 4.65 to 4.4. And it turns out that when you start, if you're as slow as 4.65, which for a wide receiver in the NFL is pretty slow, if you can get your speed down, believe it was 1/20th of a second. So 0.05 seconds, it would be worth over $600,000 to you at that level. Now, who knew that until you start doing the arithmetic? That's what's really cool about this. And then you mentioned restaurants, too. So, you know, Annika and I live in Southern California. When COVID hit, as you probably were aware, that you could go to restaurants but only eat outside. So there were a lot of restaurants converted their seating to patio seating. So we had a restaurant nearby that had a very small patio. It was probably only maybe 1/5 the size of their whole restaurant. And so the restaurant's pretty popular. And we would go there on Friday nights and we'd often be crowded out. And so about the second or third time I saw this, I motioned over to our favorite manager there. I said, "Hey, Kayla, come here." She goes, "Yeah, what is it?" She goes, "You want to make more money?" "Well, of course I want to make more money. What would you suggest?" I said, "You see all these big tables you have outside?" She had three tables of six, three tables of four, just a couple tables of two. I said, "Your average party size here is one or two. And you've got all these tables for four and six. What you need to do is take some of the tables for six and four out and replace them with tables of two." It turned out later, I went back and did some research. And in American restaurants, there are 2.25 times as many parties of two going to a restaurant as there are parties of four. So you should have more than twice as many tables for two as you do for tables of four.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so she rearranged the tables.
Yeah.
She rearranged the tables and 2 months later, her revenue shot up 25%.
Amazing.
Same space, but, you know, just rearranged in a way in which it took advantage of the hypernomics of the situation. What's the demand curve for that? And that turned out to be pretty straightforward, but that's something you can do for something down the street, you know, just your little neighborhood restaurant.
It's still amazing to me that you originally thought about this when you were a teenager. Yeah. You went to university, you had an entire career.
Right.
And then you had your epiphany and created a whole new career for yourself.
Yeah, well, in between, there was, you know, along with my history here, and interestingly, you're teaching at USC. I have a USC affiliation, too. It was there that I got the second of two kidney transplants.
Oh, wow.
And so it turned out when I was this young kid that I actually had kidney disease back when I was in high school, which in the 70s seemed to be like a death sentence.
Wow.
A brother of a friend of mine actually was a major league ball player, and he died from kidney disease back in the 70s. And so I basically heard that I had this kidney disease, and I didn't know too much about the excretory system. So I started running, trying to prevent it from getting me. And 21 years after I was diagnosed, I went on dialysis. And then I got after a year and a half of dialysis, I got a cadaveric kidney and it didn't work too well.
Oh.
But then my best friend, Tim, gave me his kidney at USC.
Amazing.
It's a different type of alum, but I'm a USC alum there in a way. And so what happens when you have this kind of condition is you're going downhill for decades, not days, decades. And so I go from, a high school kid, going downhill, 20s, 30s, 40s, 47 when I got this kidney. 22 years now, my kidney can drink. See, it hit 20. So, age 47, 30 years after I was diagnosed, all of a sudden, I get the kidney and I wake up and I'm a different person. My brain's working in a way it never worked before.
Wow.
And I think most kidney transplant or any transplant patient probably thinks, Jesus, I owe it a whole bunch to the world, including to my friend.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, all these ideas start to pour in that couldn't pour in when I was... Basically, when you get poison in your body, it goes into your head too, and it basically clouded my judgment. And all of a sudden, I had the ability to see in a way I couldn't see before. And so I'm trying to share this method now with the world, since it has been here for forever, and we're just starting to characterize it. So this is the first book in the field. It's called Hypernomics because hyper means existing in more than three dimensions, like hyperspace. And nomics comes from nonomy, N-O-M-Y, which means a field of study. So hypernomics is a field of study existing in four or more dimensions, and that's what this is. And it's existed since, you know, before the ants, at least, probably, you know, at least, you know, with the ants, at least 140 million years ago, probably predates ants too. So,
yeah. Well, I noticed a lot of your reviews were from PhDs. Do you have to have a PhD to be able to read the book and understand how to apply the concepts?
No. In fact, my first couple of drafts, actually, I'm glad you asked that because a lot of people are kind of, oh, I don't know if I can handle it. The original few drafts I had of the book, I was trying to write it to a graduate level, and everybody told me to tone it down, and that was good advice. So I took it down. For those of you who write Microsoft Word, there's a checker you can use there to see what grade level you're writing at. And so I took it, and I was deliberately writing to what I thought was a high school level, and after I got the whole thing done and hit enter, it's written to grade 11 level. And so it starts with Hansel and Gretel. And the reason it starts with Hansel and Gretel is when Hansel and Gretel are leaving rocks, they are saying, I was here. You know, as they went into the forest and tried to trace their way back, they drop these little white pebbles against the dark dirt to find their way back. I was here. Well, the same idea of those little dots being placed on the ground is it all there is to hypernomics. When we made that purchase at that store, we were saying, I was here, and we were adding one point to that entire mix there. And that's all this is just plotting dots in space and then trying to make sense of it.
Yeah.
So it starts out really simply, and the way to get to a non-negative situation, it has a very nice analogy, I think. I take my daughter and I turn her into twins, you know. Einstein had his twin experiment, so what I do is I take my daughter Megan and I turn her into Christina and Sheila. Christina is this American expatriate gaucha. She's got her little, you know, cowgirl stuff on. And then Sheila's an Australian girl, a Sheila. You know, so one studies one thing and one studies another. And so they both decide that they both like to make maps. And they both decide to go to the South Pole to put a map together like they used to do when they were kids and they had adjoining rooms. They go to the South Pole. And right now we call that 90 degrees south. But we make the little metal transformation. So what do we call, instead of calling the South Pole 90 degrees south, what do we just call that zero?
Oh.
And so if you go, interestingly, at the South Pole, America's got a station there, but America doesn't own any part of Antarctica or doesn't have any claim on it. But Australia and Argentina do. And so if you were to go from the exact South Pole and take a step into Argentina, you're going into positive Argentina space, but you can't say that you're going into negative Australia space. Mm-hmm. And if you take a step back and go to the South Pole and go into Australia, you're going into positive Australia space, but it's not negative Argentina space. And so basically what we do is we just go to the South Pole and make everything go out positive from there. And so that concept, the one book review that I have says that it's a simple read, which I was very proud about. I wanted this to be a simple read. I want high school kids to get this.
Yeah.
This is what we do. And, you know, you can put more technical jargon in if you want to. And I imagine we'll put more sophisticated books together as we go along. I do have a PhD in mathematics that wants to write another book with me. Yeah, I will make it more technical for the more technical crowd. But right now, just to start out, these are pretty simple concepts. I mean, again, if the ants know what they're doing,
yeah,
they're conveying it to other ants. They're using pheromones to basically communicate is what the thinking is, the ants.
I have a question because everybody talks about AI now. I've had AI, foremost AI experts in the world on the podcast as well.
Mm-hmm.
How do hypernomics and AI work together?
Well, we have an AI section in our software, but what we like to say is that we have a little bit less A and a little bit more I. Which is to say, I mean, when you put a problem into an AI box, mm-hmm. a lot of people call it a black box, you give it a question, and it comes out with an answer, and the answer, you know, if the AI is written right, it's going to be a good answer. But what you don't know is why it came about, what it means. And so it turns out that when you start to solve problems, we originally solved problems in four dimensions. If you look at two connected markets, like aircraft and aircraft engines, you pair them up, and they both share the price axis. You take one 4D model and another 4D model. Now you've got a seven-dimensional model, because they share the price axis. So 4 plus 4 in hypernomics equals 7. 4D plus 4D equals 7D. This gives you the visuals to be able to figure out what's going on, that an artificial intelligence would just try to blast through all this information and process out an answer.
Wow.
This could tell you, for example, a problem I did in my latest paper was that it showed that Boeing had a business jet that was up against what we call the demand frontier. That's the outer boundary of what the people will buy.
Good.
And at the same time, one of their engines, a General Electric engine that goes into this plane, it was on its demand frontier too.
Mm.
So this engine goes into this plane, and if the costs were sufficiently low for both of these manufacturers, what they could do to make more money is if the engine manufacturer and the airframe manufacturer both decided to drop their price, they both could make more money. And so this is the kind of stuff you can see when you get all these extra dimensions kind of working together at one time.
Well,
and it'd be pretty, maybe it's possible in AI, but I don't know how to do that. And
yeah.
I haven't talked to anybody in AI that knows how to do that. So we're going to try to merge ourselves with AI a little bit more, but we always want to have visuals
right.
to explain where we need to go. So, you know, I've got a series of skills. Some are good, some bad. One's pretty good skills. I'm pretty good at analytic geometry. That's what this is. And what I mean by analytic geometry is you get these lines and these surfaces. So like right here, this is a model. For those of you trying to imagine this, this is a model that shows, you're listening rather than watching. Imagine what electric cars are worth back, say, this is in 2013. So 11 years ago, the electric cars were valued for their range, which they still are, and their horsepower. And so each one of these points represents one of the models in the market. And so what this plane is trying to help us visualize is points that are above this plane, which are models, maybe overpriced, or there may be other features involved, and points below may be underpriced, or there may be other features involved. And so what we do, this is exactly the way we solve for figuring out what stocks are undervalued. Now we throw in, you know, not to get too technical, we throw in more, we look at more features than that, but that's the same idea, is you keep pushing features into this and it keeps getting more and more detailed. And what happens is the errors get smaller and smaller. And what we do in the stocks is we keep looking at the stocks and say, what stocks are undervalued? And then we run another test with some different features. What stocks are undervalued? And we do this over and over and over and over again. And then all of a sudden, you'll have, say, you know, anywhere from 5 to 20 tests that you might do, and you see who shows up being undervalued the most. And well, maybe that's somebody that you would invest in. And that's kind of what we do. We just keep looking at it that way. So,
and is that, because I know you have consulting services, you also have the software. And is this, when we're talking about stock prices, is that something that you then model and share with the outside world as well? Or is that more of an internal, so that you can...
That's kind of the secret. That's kind of the secret sauce. Yeah. We do offer training in Hypernomics. And in fact, the book is part of it, would be a training manual. But we had somebody ask us when we first put this together that they were thinking of putting a fund together with us. And they didn't want me to release the book. So the book's going to give away the secret sauce. And I go, well, you know, you go to college, you could take a calculus class, maybe take a couple of calculus classes. You know what that won't let you do? And maybe you get an A in it. You know what that won't let you do? You're not going to figure out how to plot a course to the moon or to Mars with two calculus classes. And that's what this is. These are the first courses of it. You know, this is the, well, we have a class that goes with it, but these are the first classes and books that ever come out on the topic. So to be able to go from the class to the algorithm that we have for the software is for the buying the stocks, there's a few intermediate steps that have to be taken. Now, that said, eventually everybody, we think that this will be ubiquitous in universities in 5, 10, or 20 years. I don't know what the answer is. We went to a crosstown rival of yours that used to be in the Pac-12, Pac-14.
Right.
You may have heard of them. And I went to the university and I showed the university proper, a couple of the professors, this stuff. And one guy refused to read my draft text. Another guy booted me off the phone. And they basically said, well, we don't look at any stuff, anything new, unless it's been in industry for 10 years. Well, now we've been in industry 10 years. Maybe somebody will listen to us.
Yeah.
But yeah, they've been pretty closed-minded about, some universities have been pretty closed-minded about trying to adopt this stuff. But it's inevitable. If you don't teach this stuff, you will be in an antediluvian state. You will be, you know, pre-flood. You will be, you will be behind the times. There's just too much here to ignore. I'm not saying it simply because I discovered this, but it's verifiably true that this stuff works all the time.
You can't
ignore it.
Yeah, and that's the way things are moving these days. You have to, like when I'm teaching my students, I have to be up to date on the latest news in digital media management, whether that's the newest AI tool or disruption or merger or be something else that's going on in the world, you know, the TikTok ban slash fire sale or what, all of those things. And this certainly is one of those, because really at the ultimately, our students are not just learning digital media, but they're learning how to be entrepreneurs and create their own systems and projects. And they have to come up with tangible ideas of how they're going to monetize whatever digital product they create in our classes. So they need to know this information. You can't just sit and wait. And I think that's one of the interesting things in academia is there are those who are more on the practice side who are like, yes, come here now. Let's get this into our programs.
Sure.
And then those who are maybe more reticent, the research tenured, a little more old school.
Sure. Right. Interestingly, when it comes to media, and I've done some studies here, you can appreciate this. If you plot the number of viewers versus price per commercial, you'll find that there is a demand curve every year for TV commercials. And by extension, commercials on your site and any other site, where you start out with something like the Super Bowl, which I think it was $7 million for a 30-second commercial. And then you'd have the NFL playoffs or, say, the Baseball World Series behind that, or maybe the Academy Awards, something down like that. And then you go to, you know, weekly TV shows that are popular, and then local TV shows that are popular. You finally get down to, you know, public access TV. That may have a commercial on it. And what happens is they all form the same demand frontier. And knowing the slope of that demand frontier tells you what you're able to charge, the max you could charge, and what you would need to do to be able to charge more if you need to get more viewers. It could tell you how you could improve your prices as you improve your viewership or listenership. So it's an important concept in media too.
Yeah. Well, I love all of this. When I went to Amazon to look at your book, there was one left in stock with more on the way. So I was like, oh no.
That's great.
So good on you for that, Doug. Yeah. And I know the website that people can find out everything about your services, the software, your consultation papers is hyperdomics.com.
Right. Yes, exactly. Thanks, Annika. That's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Is there anything that we haven't shared that you really want to hit home for the entrepreneurs and small businesses who are listening?
Well, just the idea that, you know, when I talk about the ants, I didn't do that just to be superfluous. The title of this can seem intimidating to people, but it really examines human behavior. And the human behavior is basically an extension of the behavior that we saw in the ants. And so the ideas in the book they're groundbreaking, but they're merely a series of observations that we collected together. It basically, what I'd like to get people to understand is that I'm taking things that you already know. You already know that if I get a bigger washing machine and I have more cycles, or if I get a car that's got a range of 300 miles as opposed to 150 miles, or that has 800 horsepower compared to 200 horsepower, you know it's worth more. You also know that there are fewer Lamborghinis sold than there's Toyota Corollas. You already know that. I'm taking all what you know, and I'm just pushing it together into a framework that you probably haven't seen before, but that one that could inform your decisions quite a bit more clearly going forward. That's all this is taking a whole bunch of things that you know and rearranging them into something you need to see. So that would be my concluding remark here, is that you just need to see it in a way in which it hasn't been displayed to you, but now we have the ability to display it that way. So that's what this does.
Yeah. And for the people who will appreciate this but not want to do it themselves, there are options for that too.
Oh, yes. Right. Well, that's why people like us would consult with people like them. And
exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah. And then typically people like that would want to have eventually hire people in their own firm that would be trained by people like us so that they could do it for themselves. Because it's not overwhelming. The math is early college level. Accepting maybe some of the analytic geometry, but, you know, it's pretty straightforward for most fairly adept college kids. And so, again, it only takes things that you know and reassembles them in a way in which you need to use it, you need to see it. So,
wonderful.
Yes.
Doug, thank you so much for being here and sharing your energy. I love this. I just had posted on LinkedIn a few days ago that I had this whole series of meeting amazing people on this college tour that my daughter and I did. Yeah. We met Anita Archer, Dr. Anita Archer, who is the foremost expert in pedagogy. And she was speaking at a conference on her 77th birthday. We met Clarence B. Thomas because we sat next to him in a restaurant in Palo Alto, and he was sharing his entire history with us.
Wow.
And he's 93, and I'm just like, I feel like I'm turning 50 this year, and I have another 30 or 40 years that I can produce and ideate and create and come up with concepts. And I love that you can retire from one thing, and then that concept that's been percolating in your mind since you were a teenager can all of a sudden develop into a patent and a book series and consulting and software and all these other amazing things. So I just, I love this conversation. Definitely to be continued.
Great.
I do ask if you have a favorite quote, mantra, or other words of wisdom that you'd like to share.
Yeah, it's kind of personal, but I have this book by David Goggins up there, Can't Hurt Me. For those of you who haven't heard of David Goggins, he's a Navy SEAL that took 3 tries to get through being a Navy SEAL because he kept breaking himself down. And he's ultra marathoner. His favorite quote is, "Don't stop when you're tired, stop when you're done." That's one of my favorite quotes.
Well, you are a true testament to that. So thank you so much for being on the show
today. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
And to the audience, thank you for watching or listening to this episode of Your Brand Amplified. I'll be back again tomorrow with another amazing guest expert and their story to help inspire you on your journey. Want more? Check out amplifywithannika.com or follow me on socials at amplifywithannika. As we close out today's episode, I want to thank Simplified again for making it possible. For all marketers and creators out there, Simplified is your ally in effortlessly crafting on-brand content with design and video AI. Discover how AI can enhance your creative process at simplify.com. Start for free and elevate your content game. Thanks for listening, and here's to your next creative breakthrough.